friends. Quick Ben and Kalam might be face down in some alley for all they knew, and that made it hard. Whiskey Jack's gaze strayed to one of the beds, on which lay his armor and longsword. Rust stained the Holberg's tattered chain like old blood. The links were missing in some places, torn in others. In his bones and muscles, the memory of that damage remained. Every cut, every blow now haunted him with aches, greeting him each morning like old comrades. The sword, with its plain leather-wrapped grip and stub hilt, lay in its hide over wood scabbard, the belt and straps draped over the bedside. That weapon had come to him after his first battle, found amid a field of dead. It still had the chalk of his father's quarry on his boots then, and a world's promise stretched out before him on the banners of empire. The sword had come to him shiny, without even so much as a nick in its honed blade, and he had taken it as his own personal standard. Whiskey Jack's gaze lost its focus. His mind had stepped into the grey, muddy tracks of his youth, where he walked with the familiar path, lost and blinded by an unidentifiable sorrow. The door flew open, carrying into the room a gust of steamy air and then Trot's. The bar-gassed coal dark eyes met the sergeant's. Whiskey Jack stood quickly. He went to the bed and retrieved his sword. At the table, the others remained intent on their card game, their only betrayal of anxiety, a subtle shifting of chairs. Whiskey Jack pushed past Trots and closed the door to a crack, through which he looked. Across the street, at the mouth of an alley, two figures crouched, the larger leaning heavily against the other. Whiskey Jack's breath hissed through his teeth. "Mallet," he said over his shoulder. At the table, the healer frowned at the two saboteurs, then carefully set down his cards. The two figures in the alley crossed the street. Whiskey Jack's hand crept to grip his sword. "Which?" Mallet asked, as he rearranged the blankets on one of the beds.
"Kalam,"
the sergeant replied. The two men reached the door, and he swung it wide to let them through, then shut it again. He beckoned at Trots, who walked over to the curtained window, pulling back a corner to watch the street. Kalam was pale, sagging against Quick Ben. The assassin's dark grey shirt was soaked with blood. Mallet moved to help the wizard, and together they carried Kalam to the bed. As soon as the healer had him laid out, he moved Quick Ben away and began removing Kalam's shirt. Quick Ben shook his head at Whiskey Jack and sat down in the chair Mallet had occupied.
"What's the game?"
he asked, picking up Mallet's cards and frowning as he studied them. Neither Hedge nor Fiddler replied.
"No idea,"
Whiskey Jack said, as he walked over to stand behind Mallet.
"They just sit and stare."
Quick Ben grinned.
"Ah, a waiting game, right, Fid?"
He leaned back comfortably and stretched out his legs. Mallet glanced up at the sergeant.
"He'll be down for a while," the healer said. "The wound is clean, but he's lost a lot of blood."
Crouching, Whiskey Jack studied the assassin's pallid face. Kalam's gaze remained sharp, focused on the sergeant.
"Well?" Whiskey Jack demanded. "What happened?"
Quick Ben answered behind him.
"Had a bit of a mage duel out there."
Kalam nodded in confirmation.
"And?"
Whiskey Jack asked, straightening to glare at the wizard. Quick Ben wilted slightly in his chair.
"It went sour. I had to release an Empire demon to get us out alive."
Everyone in the room went still. At the window, Trots turned and made a tribal warding gesture, tracing the woad lines on his face. Whiskey Jack's voice was soft.
"It's loose in the city?"
"No,"
the wizard answered.
"It's dead."
"Who did you run into?"
Whiskey Jack bellowed, throwing up his hands.
"Not sure exactly," Quick Ben said quietly. "Whatever it was, it took care of the demon in less than a minute. I heard the death cry when we were only a block away. Assassin mages, sergeant, coming down out of the sky. seemed intent on wiping out the city's guild.
Whiskey Jack returned to his chair and dropped into it, the wood complaining beneath him.
From the sky. Tista Andy.
Yes, Quick Ben muttered. We thought that. The sorcery had that flavor. Old, dark, and icy cold. Kurald Galain.
From what we saw, Kalam added, they did a damn good job. No contact established, Sergeant. It was messy up there.
So the moon's active here.
Whiskey Jack paused, then pounded his fist on the chair's arm.
Worse, the moon's lord is a move ahead of us. He reckoned we'd try to contact the guild. So what does he do?
He takes out the guild, Kalam said. How's that for arrogance?
Whatever arrogance that lord has, Whiskey Jack said, grimacing, he's earned it. I'll give him that. I wonder how good this city's guildmaster is. Good enough to take on Tista Andy?
Unlikely.
And about the other thing, Quick Ben said. It worked.
The sergeant stared at the wizard for half a dozen seconds, then nodded.
We also ran into Sorry, Kalam said, wincing as Mallet placed a hand on his wound.
The healer muttered under his breath.
Well, I sent her after some fat man she thought was important. How come she ran into you two?
Quick Ben's brows had risen.
So she told the truth then. We don't know how she found us, but she'd found the man we were looking for and gave him to us.
Mallet raised his hand. Where the wound had been, there was now a pink scar. Kalam grunted his thanks and sat up. Whiskey Jack tapped his fingers against the chair's arm.
If we only knew who was running this damn city, we could try it ourselves.
The assassin sniffed.
If we start taking out council members, maybe we'll flush out the real rulers.
The sergeant frowned.
Not bad, he said, rising to his feet. Work on that. The Moon's Lord knows we're here now, with that demon popping up. We'll have to move fast.
Fiddler spoke up.
We could blow up Majesty Hall,
he said, smirking at Hedge.
You've got enough munitions to manage that?
Whiskey Jack asked. Fiddler's face fell.
Well, we've got enough to take out an estate, maybe. But if we pull up some of the mines we planted...
Whiskey Jack sighed.
This is getting absurd. No, we leave things as they are.
He watched the non-existent card game. It seemed to involve complete immobility. A standoff. The sergeant's eyes narrowed. Were they trying to tell him something? Orange and yellow hues lit the eastern horizon, casting a coppery sheen upon the city's bricks and cobbles. Apart from the dripping of water, the streets were quiet, though the first emergings of citizenry were minutes away. Soon those farmers who had depleted their supplies of grains, fruits, and root crops would take to their carts and wagons and depart the city. Merchant shops and stalls would open to catch the morning wave of shoppers. Throughout Darujistan, the grey faces prepared to shut the valves feeding gas to the torches lining the major avenues. These figures moved in small groups, gathering at intersections, then dispersing with the day's first bell. Sorry watched Crocus wearily ascend a tenement's front steps. She stood half a block down the street, within shadows that seemed reluctant to disappear despite the growing light. A short while earlier, she had felt the Empire Demon's death strike her almost physically, deep in her chest. Normally, demons fled back to their realm once enough damage had been inflicted on them, enough to sever the links of summoning. But the Kovala had not been simply cut down or forcibly dismissed. There had been a finality to its end that had left her shaken, a death in truth. She still recalled its silent, despairing scream ringing in her head. All the ambivalence surrounding the coin-bearer was gone, driven away. She knew now she would kill him. It had to be done, and soon. All that remained before she could do so was the mystery of his actions. To what extent was Opon using the boy?
She knew he'd seen her in the Dahl's garden just before he had escaped to the estate's roof. Seeing the light come on behind the balcony's sliding doors had clinched her decision to continue following Crocus. The Dahl family was powerful in Darujistan. That the boy seemed to be involved in a clandestine love affair with the daughter was an outrageous proposition. Yet what else could she conclude? So the question remained. Was Opon working through the boy directly, insinuating a peculiar influence with the city council? What powers of influence did this young maiden possess? Only a matter of position, of possible scandal. Yet what was the political position of Councilman Estrasian Dahl? Sori realized that even though she had learned much of Darujistan's political arena, she still did not know enough to second-guess Opon's moves. Councilman Dahl was Turban Or's principal opposition on this proclamation of neutrality business. But what did that matter? The Malazan Empire could not care less, unless the proclamation was no more than a feint. Was this Turban Or seeking to lay the groundwork for an empire-backed coup? The answers to such questions would be slow in coming. She knew she'd have to exercise patience. Of course, patience was her finest quality. She'd hoped that showing herself to Crocus a second time, there in the garden, might trigger panic in the lad, or, at the very least, annoy Opon if indeed the god's control was as direct as that. Sori had watched on, from the shadows she drew around her, as the assassin named Ralik took the lad to task. She'd also lingered to catch the conversation between Ralik and Murillo. It seemed the boy had protectors, and an odd lot they were, assuming that the fat little man Crupper was some kind of group leader. Hearing that they were to take Crocus out of the city on behalf of their master made the whole situation even more intriguing. She knew she'd have to make a move soon. The protection offered by Crupper and this Murillo would not impede her much, she expected. Though Crupper was certainly more than he seemed, violence hardly seemed his major skill. She would kill Crocus then, outside the city. As soon as she discovered the nature of their mission and who their master was. As soon as everything had fallen into place. Sergeant Whiskey Jack would have to wait a while longer for her return. Sori smiled at that, knowing full well how relieved the whole squad would be that she was nowhere to be seen. As for that whole matter, the threat presented by Quick Ben and Kalam, well, everything in its own time. Alchemist Baruch's savage migraine was ebbing. Whatever presence had been unleashed in the city was gone. He sat in his reading chair, pressing a cloth-wrapped chunk of ice against his forehead. It had been a conjuring. He felt certain of that. The emanation stank of demonry. But there had been more. The moment before the presence vanished, Baruch had experienced a mental wrench that came close to driving him into unconsciousness. He had shared the creature's final death scream, his own shriek echoing down the hall and bringing his men-at-arms shouting to his bedroom door. Baruch felt a wrongness deep within him, as if his soul had been battered. For a single brief second, he had looked upon a world of absolute darkness, and from that darkness came sounds. The creak of wooden wheels, the clank of chains, the groans of 1,000 imprisoned souls. Then it was gone, and he found himself sitting in his chair, rolled kneeling at his side with a pail of ice from the cellar. He now sat in his study, alone, and the ice pressed against his brow was warm compared to what he felt in his heart. There was a knock at the door, and Roald entered, his face creased with worry.
Lord, you have a visitor.
I have, at this hour.
He rose shakily to his feet.
Who is it?
Lord Anamanda Rake,
Roald hesitated. And another. Frowning, Baruch waved a hand.
Bring them in.
Yes, Lord.
Rake entered, holding a dog-sized winged creature by the nape of its neck.
The creature twisted and hissed, then turned pleading eyes to Baruch.
"This thing was following me here," Rake said. "Yours?"
Startled, Baruch managed a nod.
"I thought as much,"
Rake said, releasing the demon to flap across the room and land at the alchemist's slippered feet. Baruch gazed down on it. The demon was trembling. Rake strode to a chair and sat, stretching out his long legs.
"A busy night," he said.
Baruch gestured and the demon vanished with a faint popping sound.
"Indeed," he said, his voice hard. "My servant was on a mission. I had no idea it would involve you."
He went to stand before the Tista Andii.
"Why were you in the middle of an assassin war?"
"Why not?" Rake answered. "I started it."
"What?"
He smiled up at Baruch.
"You don't know the Empress as well as I do, Baruch."
"Please, explain."
Color had risen in the alchemist's face. Rake looked away.
"Tell me this, Baruch," he said, turning to meet the alchemist's gaze. "Who in this city is most likely to be aware of your secret council? And who might benefit the most from your removal? And, most importantly, who in this city is capable of killing you?"
Baruch did not answer immediately. He walked slowly to the table where a newly painted map had been laid out. He leaned over it, hands resting on the edge.
"You suspect the Empress might seek out Vorkan," he said, "a contract to offer."
"On you and the rest of the High Mages," Rake said behind him. "The Empress has sent a claw here, not so much to worry your city's defenses, but to establish contact with the Master Assassin. I wasn't entirely certain that I was right in this, but I meant to prevent that contact."
Baruch's eyes remained on the map's red wash.
"So you sent your own assassins to wipe out her guild, to flush her out?"
He faced Rake.
"And then what? Kill her? All on the basis of some suspicion of yours?"
"This night," Rake said calmly, "we prevented the claw from making that contact. Your demon's report will confirm this. Besides, you aren't suggesting that the death of Vorkan and the decimation of the city's assassins is a bad thing, are you?"
"I fear I am."
Baruch was pacing, struggling against a growing sense of outrage.
"I may not know the Empress as well as you, Rake," he said, gritting his teeth. "But I do know this city. Far better than you ever will."
He glared at the Tista Andii.
"To you, Darujistan is just another battleground for your private war with the Empress. You don't give a damn about how this city survives, how it has managed to survive 3,000 years.
Rake shrugged.
"Enlighten me."
"The city council has its function, a vital one. They are the city's machine. True, Majesty Hall is a place of pettiness, corruption, endless bickering. But despite all that, it's also a place where things get done."
"What's that got to do with Vorkan and her gang of killers?"
Baruch grimaced.
"Like any burdened wagon, the wheels require grease. Without the option of assassination, the noble families would have long since destroyed themselves, taking the city with them through civil war. Secondly, the guild's efficiency provides a measure of control on vendettas, arguments, and so forth. It is the guaranteed option of bloodshed, and bloodshed is messy, usually too messy for the nobility's sensibilities."
"Curious," Rake said. "Nevertheless, don't you think that Vorkan would listen very carefully indeed to an offer from the Empress? After all, Lassine has the precedent of handing over the rule of a conquered city to an assassin. In fact,
At least a third of her present high fists come from that profession.
You are missing the point. Baruch's face was dark. You did not consult us. And that cannot be tolerated.
You haven't answered me, Rake retorted, in a voice quiet and cold. Would Vorkan take the contract? Could she manage it? Is she that good, Baruch?
The alchemist turned away.
I don't know. That's my answer to all three questions.
Rake stared hard at Baruch. If you were indeed nothing more than an alchemist, I might believe you.
Baruch's smile was wry.
Why would you think me anything but?
Now it was Rake's turn to smile. There are few who would argue with me without flinching. I am unused to being addressed as an equal.
There are many paths to ascendancy, some more subtle than others.
Baruch walked over to the mantel above the fireplace, took a carafe, then went to the shelf behind his desk and retrieved two crystal goblets.
She's a high mage. We all have magical defenses. But against her...
He filled the goblets with wine.
Rake joined the alchemist. He accepted the glass and raised it between them.
I apologize for not informing you. In truth, the thought hadn't crossed my mind as being especially important. Until tonight, I was acting on a theory, nothing more. I didn't consider the ripples a grounded guild might cause.
Baruch sipped his wine. And Amanda Rake, tell me something. There was a presence in our city tonight, a conjuring.
One of Taishrin's Korvala demons, Rake answered, released by a claw wizard.
He took a mouthful of the tart liquid, let it roll for a moment, then swallowed with satisfaction.
It's gone.
Gone? Baruch asked quietly. Where?
Out of Taishren's reach, Rake said, a tight smile on his lips. Out of anyone's reach.
Your sword, Baruch said, repressing a shiver as the memory of that closing vision returned to him. The creak of wheels, the clank of chains, the groans of a thousand lost souls. And darkness.
Oh, yes, Rake said, refilling his goblet. I received the two pale wizards' heads, as you promised. I admire your efficiency, Baruch. Did they protest?
Baruch paled. I explained to them the options, he said quietly. No, they didn't protest.
Rake's soft laugh chilled the blood in Baruch's veins. At the distant sound, Cropper rose. The small fire flickered steadily before him, but its heat seemed less.
Ah! He sighed. Cropper's hands are near numb, yet his ears are as sharp as ever. Listen to this faint sound in the very nether regions of his present dream. Does he know its source?
Perhaps, Kral said beside him.
Startled, Cropper turned, his eyebrows rising.
Cropper thought you long gone, Eldering One. Nonetheless, he is thankful for your company.
The hooded god nodded.
All is well with the child Tatasail, the Rivi protector, and she grows swiftly, as is the nature of soul taken. A powerful warlord now shelters her.
Good!
Cropper said, smiling. The noises in the distance drew his attention again. He stared out into the darkness, seeing nothing.
Tell me, Cropper, Kral said, what do you hear?
The passing of a great wagon or some such thing, he replied with a frown. I hear its wheels and chains and the groaning of slaves.
Its name is Dragnipur, Kral said, and it is a sword.
Crupper's frown deepened.
How can a wagon and slaves be a sword?
Forged in darkness, it chains souls to the world that existed before the coming of light. Crupper, its wielder, is among you.
In Crupper's mind, his deck of dragons rose. He saw the image of half-man, half-dragon, the Knight of High House Darkness, also known as the Son of Darkness. The man held aloft a black sword trailing smoky chains.
"The Knight is in Darujistan?"
he asked, fighting a shiver of fear.
"In Darujistan," Kral replied. "Around Darujistan, above Darujistan. His presence is a lodestone to power, and great is the danger."
The Elder God faced Crupper.
"He is in league with Master Baruch and the Torad Cabal. Darujistan's secret rulers have found a two-edged ally. Dragnipur tasted a demon soul this night, Crupper, in your city. It is never thirsty for long, and it will feed on more blood before this is done."
"Can anyone withstand it?"
Crupper asked. Kral shrugged.
"None could when it was first forged, but that was long ago. I cannot answer for the present. I have one other piece of information, Crupper. A small piece, I'm afraid."
"Crupper hearkens."
"The journey Master Baruch is sending you on to the Gadrobi Hills. Elder magic brews anew after so long. It is Telan of the Aimas. But what it touches is Omtos Felak, Jaghalt Elder Magic. Crupper, stay out of their way. Especially guard the coin bearer. What is about to come is a danger as grave as the knight and his sword, and as ancient. Step carefully, Crupper."
"Crupper always steps carefully, Eldering One."
Book 5. The Gadrobi Hills. Beyond these thin hide walls, a child sits. Before her, on worn silk, a deck is arrayed. She cannot yet speak, and the scenes before her, she's never before seen in this life. The child gazes upon a lone card, named Obelisk. The stone grey, she can feel its roughness in her mind. Obelisk stands buried in a grassy knoll, like a knuckle protruded from the earth, past and future. This child's eyes are wide with terror, for cracks have appeared in the stone of stones, and she knows the shattering is begun. Silver Fox, Outrider Herlakel, 6th Army. Chapter 14. I saw them on the shores, the deepening pits of their gaze vowed immortal war against the sighing calm of Jaghat seas. Gothos Folly. Gothos. Birthdate unknown. Nine 907th year in the third millennium. The season of Phandaray in the year of the five tusks. By Malazan reckoning, 1163rd year of Burn's sleep. Talan Imas reckoning, the year of gathering. Telan arise. As the days passed, Adjunct Lorne felt a sharpness return to her mind, the exhaustion and depression fading away. The thought that she could allow herself to slip into carelessness so easily had left her shaken, and that was not a feeling with which she was familiar. She did not know how to deal with it, and this kept her unbalanced, not quite sure of her own efficacy.
As the Gedrobi Hills appeared, first to the south and then to the west as well, she sensed a desperate urgency to regain her confidence. The mission approached a vital juncture. Success with the Jaghut Barrow would almost ensure success with everything else. Since this dawn, she'd ridden hard, pushing to keep her schedule intact after traveling so slowly in the first few days. Both horses were in need of rest, so she now walked ahead of them, the reins tucked through her belt. And beside her walked Tool. Though the Imas spoke often, at her prodding, of many fascinating things, he denied her efforts regarding matters important to the Empire and to Lassine's continued power. All seemed to return to the vows he had taken at the last gathering. For the Imas, something was coming to a head. She wondered if it was somehow connected with freeing this Jaghut tyrant, and that was a disturbing thought. Still, she would not permit any ambivalence to threaten the mission. In this, she was Lassine's arm, and it was directed not of Lorne's own accord, but by the Empress. Dujek and Taishren had well reminded her of that truth. Thus, she played no role in all this, not as the woman named Lorne. How could she be held responsible for anything?
"In my years among humans," Tool said beside her, "I have come to recollect the passing of emotions in body and expressions. Adjunct, you have worn a frown the past 2 days. Is this significant?"
"No," she snapped, "it isn't." Purging her thoughts of personal feelings had never been so difficult as it was now. Was this a lasting effect of Opon's meddling? Perhaps Tool could rid her of it. "Tool," she said, "what is significant, as you put it, is that I don't know enough about what we're doing. We are seeking a standing stone, the Barrow's Marker. Well, assuming it can be found, why was it not so long ago? Why could not 3,000 years of hunting find this Barrow?"
"We will find the standing stone," Tool replied calmly. "It marks the Barrow in truth, but the Barrow is not there."
The adjunct scowled.
"More riddles," she thought.
"Explain." The Imas was silent for a minute, then he said,
"I am born of an elder warren, adjunct, known as Telan. It is more than a source of magic. It is also a time."
"Are you suggesting that the Barrow exists in a different time? Is that how you plan to reach it? By using your Telan Warren?"
"No. There is no parallel time any different from the one we know. That time is gone. Past. It is more a matter of flavor. Adjunct, may I continue?"
Lorne's mouth thinned into a straight line.
"The Jaghut who entombed the tyrant were born of a different elder warren. But the term elder is relative only to the existing warrens of this age. The Jaghut Omtos Felak is not elder when compared to Telan. They are the same, of the same flavor. Do you understand thus far, adjunct?"
"Patronizing bastard," she muttered to herself. "Yes, Tool." The Imas nodded, his bones creaking.
"The Barrow has not been found before, precisely because it is Omtos Felak. It lies within a warren now lost to the world. Yet I am Telan. My warren touches Omtos Felak. I can reach it, adjunct. Any Telan Imas could. I was chosen because I am without a clan. I am alone in every way.
Why should that be important? Lorne asked, her stomach twisting.
Tool looked at her. Adjunct, what we seek to accomplish is the freeing of a Jaghut tyrant. Such a being, should it escape our control or defy our predictions, is capable of destroying this continent. It can enslave all living upon it, and it would do so if permitted. If, instead of me, Logros had selected a bone caster, and if the tyrant was freed, that bone caster would become enslaved. A Jaghut tyrant is dangerous alone. A Jaghut tyrant with an Imass bone caster at its side is unstoppable. They would challenge the gods, and they would kill most of them. Also, I am without a clan. Thus my enslavement, should that event befall, would not enslave blood kin.
Lorne stared at the Imass. What were the Empress and Taishran thinking of? How could they hope to control this thing? You are saying, Tool, that you're expendable.
Yes, Adjunct.
And so, she realized, am I? What, she asked, will stop the tyrant? How do we control it?
We don't, Adjunct. That is the gamble we take.
And what does that mean?
Tool shrugged, an audible lifting and dropping of bones beneath the rotted furs.
The Lord of Moonspawn, Adjunct. He will have no choice but to intervene.
He's capable of stopping the tyrant?
Yes, Adjunct. He is. Although it will cost him dearly, weaken him. More, he is capable of delivering the single punishment that a Jaghut tyrant fears most.
A faint gleam of light rose in Tool's eye sockets as the Imass stared at Lorne.
Enslavement, Adjunct.
Lorne stopped in her tracks. You mean the Moon's Lord will have the tyrant working on his side?
No, Adjunct. The enslavement is by the Lord's hand, but it is beyond him as well. You see, the Empress knows who the Lord is and what he possesses.
Lorne nodded. He's Tista Andi and a high mage.
A rasp of laughter came from Tool.
Adjunct, he is Anomander Rake, the son of darkness, bearer of Dragnipur.
Lorne frowned. Tool seemed to have noticed her confusion, but the Imass elaborated.
Dragnipur is a sword, born of the age before light. And darkness, Adjunct, is the goddess of the Tista Andi.
A few minutes later, Lorne found her voice.
The Empress, she said quietly, knows how to pick her enemies.
And then Tool hit her with another stunning revelation.
I am sure, the Imass said, the Tista Andi regret their coming to this world.
They came to this world? From where? How? Why?
The Tista Andi were of Curald Galain, the Warren of Darkness. Curald Galain stood alone, untouched. The goddess, their mother, knew loneliness.
Tool hesitated.
There is probably little truth in this story, Adjunct.
Go on,
Lorne said quietly. Please.
In her loneliness, the goddess sought something outside herself. Thus was born Light. Her children, the Tista and Yi, saw this as a betrayal. They rejected her. Some hold they were cast out, others that they departed their mother's embrace by choice. While Tista and Yi mages still use the warren of Curald Galain, they are no longer of it. And some have embraced another warren, that of Starvald Demolain.
The first warren.
Tool nodded.
Whose warren did Starvald Demolain belong to?
It was the home of dragons, adjunct.
Murillo turned in his saddle and brought the mule to a halt on the dusty road. He glanced ahead. Crupper and Crocus had already reached the Wari crossroads. He patted his brow with the soft satin of his burnous, then looked back again. Hall leaned hunched over in his saddle, losing the rest of his breakfast. Murillo sighed. It was a wonder to see the man sober, but that he'd insisted on accompanying them bordered on miraculous. Murillo wondered if Cole suspected anything of Ralek's plans. But no, he would have brought a fist down on his and Ralek's head in short order if he had so much as caught a hint of what they were doing. It had been Cole's pride that had got him into this present mess, and drink did nothing to diminish it. To the contrary, in fact. Cole had even donned his brigandine armor, replete with arm and leg greaves. A bastard sword hung at the large man's hip, and with his mail coif and helmet, he looked every inch a noble knight. The only exception was the green tinge to his rounded face. He was also the only one of them to have found a horse instead of these damned mules Crupper had scrounged. Cole straightened in his saddle and smiled wanly at Murillo, then spurred his horse alongside. They resumed the journey without a word, nudging their mounts into a canter until they'd caught up with the others. As usual, Crupper was pontificating.
No more than a handful of days, assures Crupper, wizened traveller of the wastes beyond glittering Darujistan. No reason to be so glum, lad. Consider this a mighty adventure.
Crocus looked to Murillo and threw up his hands.
Adventure? I didn't even know what we're doing out here. Won't anybody tell me anything? I can't believe I agreed to this.
Murillo grinned at the boy.
Come now, Crocus. How many times have you expressed curiosity about our constant travels outside the city? Well, here we are. All your questions are about to find answers.
Crocus hunched down in his saddle.
You told me you all worked as agents for some merchant. What merchant? I don't see any merchant. And where's our horses? How come Cole's the only one with a horse? How come nobody gave me a sword or something? Why?
Right! Murillo laughed, holding up a hand. Enough, please. We are agents for a merchant, he explained. But it's rather unusual merchandise we're acquiring.
A rather unusual merchant as well, Crupper adds with a warm smile. Lad, we are agents seeking information on behalf of our employer, who is none other than High Alchemist Baruch.
Crocus stared at Crupper.
Baruch? And he can't afford to give us horses?
Crupper cleared his throat.
Ah, yes. Well, that was something of a misunderstanding between worthy honest Crupper and a conniving deceitful stabler. Nonetheless, Crupper received full recompense, thus saving our kind master 11 silver coins.
Which he'll never see, Murillo muttered.
Crupper went on.
As for a sword, lad, what on earth for? Ignore blustery, pallid Cole there, with all his sweaty trappings of war.
a mere affectation of his, and Murillo's rapier is no more than an ornamental trifle, though no doubt he would claim that the jewels and emeralds studding said item's hilt are toward achieving fine balance, or some such martial detail.
Cropper smiled beatifically at Murillo.
Nay, lad, the true masters at acquiring information need no such clumsy pieces of metal. Indeed, we disdain them.
Okay, Crocus grumbled. What kind of information are we looking for, then?
All that yon ravens overhead can see, Cropper said, waving a hand in the air. Other travellers, other efforts within the Gadrobi Hills, all grist for Master Baruch's mill of news. We observe without being observed. We learn while remaining a mystery to all. We ascend to the... Well, you shut up! Col moaned. Who brought the waterskins?
Smiling, Murillo removed a clay jug webbed in twine from his saddle horn and handed it to Col.
A sponge, Cropper said. Squeezed beneath the burden of armor. See the man down our precious water. See it immediately reappear, salty and grimy on his weathered skin. What yon poisons have leaked forth? Cropper shudders at the thought.
Col ignored him, handing the jug to Crocus.
Back up, lad, he said. You're getting paid, and damn well. With luck, there'll be no trouble. Believe me, in this kind of work, excitement is the last thing we're looking for. Still,
he glared at Murillo,
I'd feel a whole lot better if Ralik were with us.
Crocus bristled.
And I'm an unworthy stand-in, right? You think I don't know that, Col? You think...
Don't tell me what I think, Col rumbled. I never said you were a stand-in, Crocus. You're a thief, and those kinds of skill come in a lot handier than anything I could manage. The same for Murillo. And as for Cropper, well, his talents extend no further than his stomach and whatever he wants jammed in it. You and Ralik share a lot more than you think, and that's why you're the most qualified man here. Barring the necessary brains, of course, Cropper said, which is my true skill. Though one such as Col would never understand such abilities, alien as they are to him.
Col leans toward Crocus.
You're wondering why I'm wearing all this armor, he whispered loudly. It's because Cropper's in charge. When Cropper's in charge, I don't feel safe unless I'm prepared for war. If it comes to that, lad, I'll get us out alive.
He leaned back and stared straight ahead.
I've done it before. Right, Cropper? Absurd accusations,
Cropper sniffed.
So, Crocus said, what are we supposed to be on the lookout for?
We'll know it when we see it,
Murillo said. He nodded toward the hills rising to the east.
Up there.
Crocus was silent for a time, then his eyes narrowed.
The Gadrobi Hills. Are we looking for a rumor, Murillo?
Murillo stiffened, but it was Cropper who replied.
Indeed, lad. Rumors upon rumors. I applaud your cunning conclusion. Now, where is that water jug? Cropper's thirst has become intense.
Sari's departure through Jammet's gate was casual, unhurried. Tracking the coin-bearer was simple, and did not require that the boy remain within her range of vision. She sensed Crocus and Cropper, in the company of two others, on the road a league beyond Warrytown. They did not seem to be in any kind of rush. Whatever mission they were on, that it concerned the welfare of Darujistan was plain. Thinking on it, Sari was sure that the men within that group were spies, and, in all likelihood, able ones. The dandy, Murillo, could move through noble-born circles with an ease coupled with a desirable coyness, the perfect combination for a spy. Ralik, though he did not accompany them on this mission, was the eyes and ears within the Assassin's Guild, thus covering another power base. Crupper's world
was that of the thieves and lower classes, whence rumors sprang to life like weeds in muddy soil. The third man was clearly a military man, no doubt serving as the group's sword arm. On a mundane level, then, an adequate group to protect the coin-bearer, though insufficient to prevent her killing him, especially with the assassin left behind. Yet something nagged within Sorry's mind, a vague suspicion that the group was heading into danger, a danger that threatened her as well. Once beyond Worrytown, she picked up her pace. As soon as she found herself alone on the road, she opened her warren of shadow and slipped into its swift tracks. The adjunct could find nothing to set apart the hill they approached. Its grass-cloaked summit was dwarfed by those around it. A half-dozen scraggly, wind-twisted scrub oaks climbed one side amid a scree of broken boulders. The summit flattened out into a rough circle, rock pushing through here and there. Overhead wheeled ravens, so high as to be no more than specks against the muggy grey sky. Lorne watched Tool striding ahead of her, the eye mass choosing an unwavering path toward the hill's base. She slumped in her saddle, feeling defeated by the world around her. The midday heat sapped her strength, and the sluggishness reached through to her thoughts. Not O'Pon's doing, she knew. This was the pervasive dread clinging to the air, the sense that what they were doing was wrong, terribly wrong. To fling this Jaghut tyrant into the hands of the Empire's enemy, to trust this Tista Andi Anamanda rake to destroy it, yet at great cost to himself, thus opening the way for Malazan's sorceries in turn to kill the Son of Darkness, now seemed precipitous, absurd in its ambitions. Tool came to the base of the hill and waited for the adjunct to arrive. Lorne saw, at Tool's hide-wrapped feet, a grey rock jutting perhaps 10 inches from the earth.
"Adjunct," the Imas said, "this is the barrow marker we seek."
She raised an eyebrow.
"There's hardly any soil cover here at all," she said. "Are you suggesting this standing stone has eroded down to its present size?"
"The stone has not eroded," Tool answered. "It has stood here since before the sheets of ice came to cover this land. It stood here when the Rivi Plain was an inland sea, long before the waters withdrew to what is now Lake Azure. Adjunct, the stone is in fact taller than both of us combined, and what you think to be bedrock is shale."
Lorne was surprised at the hint of anger in Tool's voice. She dismounted and set to hobbling the horses.
"How long do we stay here, then?"
"Until this evening passes. With tomorrow's dawn, I will open the way, adjunct."
Faintly from above came the cries of ravens. Lorne lifted her head and gazed at the specks wheeling high over them. They'd been with them for days. Was that unusual? She didn't know. Shrugging, she unsaddled the horses. The IMS remained motionless, his gaze seeming fixed on the stone marker. Lorne went about preparing her camp. Among the scrub oaks, she found wood for a small cooking fire. It was dry, weathered, and likely to yield little smoke. Though she did not anticipate company, caution had become her habit. Before dusk arrived, she found a nearby hill higher than those around it, and ascended to its summit. From this position, she commanded a view that encompassed leagues on all sides. The hills continued their roll southward, sinking to steps to the southeast. Due east of them stretched Catlin Plain, empty of life as far as she could see. Lorne turned to the north. The forest they had travelled round a few days ago was still visible, a dark line thickening as it swept westward to the Tarlin Mountains. She sat down and waited for night to fall.
It was then that she'd be able to spot any campfires. Even as night fell, the heat remained oppressive. Lorne walked around the hill's summit to stretch her legs. She found evidence of past excavations, scars that dug into the shale. And evidence of the Kedrubi herders remained, from as far back as when they fashioned stone tools. Against the south side of the hill, the ground had been carved out, not in search of a barrow, but as a stone quarry. It appeared that beneath the shale was flint, chocolate brown, sharp-edged, and crusted in white chalk. Curious, Lorne investigated further, scrambling down into the cavity. Stone flakes carpeted the pit's base. She crouched and picked up a piece of flint. It was the tip of a spear point, expertly shaped. The echo of this technology was found in Tull's chalcedony sword. She needed no further proof of the Imas's assertions. Humans had indeed come from them, had indeed inherited a world. Empire was a part of them, a legacy flowing like blood through human muscle, bone, and brain. But such a thing could easily be seen as a curse. Were they destined one day to become human versions of the Talan Imas? Was war all there was? Would they bow to it in immortal servitude, no more than deliverers of death? Lorne sat down in the quarry and leaned against the chiseled, weathered stone. The Imas had conducted a war of extermination lasting hundreds of thousands of years. Who or what had the Jaghat been? According to Tull, they had abandoned the concept of government and turned their backs on empires, on armies, on the cycles of rise and fall, fire and rebirth. They had walked alone, disdainful of their own kind, dismissive of community, of purposes greater than themselves. They would not, she realized, have started a war.
"Oh, Lassine," she murmured, tears welling in her eyes. "I know why we fear this Jaghat tyrant. Because he became human. He became like us. He enslaved, he destroyed, and he did it better than we could."
She lowered her head into her hands.
"That's why we fear."
She fell silent then, letting the tears roll down her cheeks, seep between her fingers, trickle along her wrists. Who wept from her eyes? She wondered. Was it Lorne or Lassine? Or was it for our kind? What did it matter? Such tears had been shed before and would be again, by others like her and yet unlike her. And the winds would dry them all. Captain Parron glanced at his companion. "You've got a theory about all this?" he asked. Tok the Younger scratched his scar.
"Damned if I know, Captain."
He stared down at the black, burned, crusted raven lying on the ground in front of them.
"I've been counting, though. That's the 11th roasted bird in the last 3 hours. And unless they're covering the Rivi plain like some bloody carpet, it seems we're on somebody's trail."
Parron grunted, then kicked his horse forward. Tok followed.
"And it's a nasty somebody," he continued. "Those ravens looked like they was blasted from the inside out. Hell, even the flies avoid them."
"In other words," Parron grated,
"sorcery."
Tok squinted at the hill south of them. They'd found a woodcutter's trail through the Talin forest, shaving days off their journey. As soon as they'd returned to the Rivi trader's track, however, they'd found the ravens, and also the signs of two horses, and one moccasined man on foot. This latter group of tracks was only a few days old.
"Can't understand why the adjunct and that Imas are moving so slowly,"
Tok muttered, repeating words he'd uttered a dozen times since the day's beginning.
"You think she doesn't know someone's trailing her?"
"She's an arrogant woman," Parron said, his free hand gripping his sword. "And with that Imas with her, why should she worry?"
"Power draws power,"
Tok said, scratching again at his scar. The motion triggered yet another flash of light in his head, but it was changing. At times, he thought he could almost see images, scenes within the light. Damn Seven Sissy superstitions, anyway, he growled under his breath. Perrin looked at him oddly.